I'm Brian Katulis from the Center for American Progress.
And I'm Daniel Levy from the New America Foundation. We're going to be talking about the Middle East today with an emphasis on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Brian and Mark Lynch have produced for CAP a report recently on the two-state solution. And we thought that maybe Brian would kick off by talking briefly about that report and about the Obama administration's efforts on this issue.
Great. Thanks, Daniel. You can find this report at our website at AmericanProgress.org. The report is the result of a trip we took at the end of June to Israel, the West Bank, and Jerusalem. We did not go into the Gaza Strip, unfortunately. And we're looking at this as a 5 month into the Obama administration. How are things looking on the Israeli-Palestinian front? I used to live in Ramallah and the Gaza Strip back in the 1990s. I worked on democracy and governance issues in the Palestinian Authority from 1995, essentially, till 1998. So I have a bit of on-the-ground experience out there, and I've been back pretty regularly on trips with CAP and with a number of other organizations. And this was a trip, I think, designed at just taking the temperature of how things are looking on the Israeli-Palestinian front. Before I get into the trip and the trip report and our conversation, I just wanted to say a few things about what I see as the Obama administration's approach to the Middle East, because I actually think it's quite, there's a great deal of potential for a major strategic shift. Back in 2007, I wrote a report called Strategic Reset, which was largely focused on Iraq, but had a good bit about what I felt like the United States should do more broadly in the Middle East. And this report came out in the wake of the Baker-Hamilton Commission, the Iraq Study Group report, which I actually see as one of the fundamentals that still guide the Obama administration's philosophy of looking at the region holistically, looking at all of the challenges from Iran to Iraq to the Arab-Israeli front, to a certain extent as issues that you need to actually manage simultaneously, that you can't afford to focus on one track or one issue versus the other. And I think if you look at the Obama administration, they started early on in appointing a fairly high-level team to deal with the full range of issues, engaging early and engaging often. So I have high hopes and expectations about what the Obama administration can do. I think they've put into place the right sort of team, have sent the right sorts of messages, at least initially, on the full range of issues in the Middle East, in the speeches that President Obama gave in Turkey and in Cairo earlier this year. That all said, I think the Arab-Israeli issue, and particularly the Israeli-Palestinian issue, in this broader regional context, I think is important to keep in mind in terms of priorities, because this is an administration that's trying to do a lot on a lot of fronts. And when I look at some other places that I've been to recently, like Pakistan and countries that I will go to, like Afghanistan, the sorts of resources and attention, I think, that are dedicated to those sorts of problems, like Afghanistan and Pakistan, will dwarf any sort of military assistance or economic assistance that we put focus on in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian context. If you look at just the sheer population on the Israeli-Palestinian front, you're talking about 5% of the people that exist there, that live there, 5% of what we have in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So I think in the broader context of Obama administration policy, to a certain extent, there's been a shift in the high-level focus a bit eastward, while at the same time trying to manage issues on the Israeli-Palestinian front. So in that context, we went to one of the key fronts, the Arab-Israeli front, the core Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and tried to look at President Obama's stated goal of a two-state solution and to see, you know, how things were coming along on that front. And we came away with the distinct impression that there is a moment of opportunity, but a closing window for that moment of opportunity to achieve a two-state solution. On the Israeli side, I think there's a lot of concern about the ability of this Israeli government to move forward in a way that actually protects the security of Israel. On the Palestinian side, there's a lot of division, internal divisions among the different factions. So a difficult landscape, but I think one, if the Obama administration and other outside actors keep focusing on trying to move the ball forward somewhat, you could see some results. and the workings of a strategy that I think still need to be detailed. A couple of issues in terms of this window of opportunity, things that we emphasized in the report that I think were essential for the Obama administration to focus on. One was to think a little bit more about the issue of Palestinian unity and the internal Palestinian politics. I know they're looking at the situation there, but it struck us that with the possibility of elections in January of next year, which seem to have been postponed at least a few months, if not another year, with that possibility, there needs to be more thinking about the intra-Palestinian political dynamics. And I know this is something Daniel and I will talk about.
Yeah.
But it struck us that some of the initiatives to help develop the Palestinian economy, to build the Palestinian security forces, though very important in and of themselves, are only tactics if it's not tied to a broader strategy of how to actually help the Palestinians achieve a certain degree of unity and consolidation of power, which is a very extremely difficult thing. And I know Daniel and I will talk about that. But
let's touch on this issue now, Brian.
Good.
I mean, since you've raised it, and I'll take a step back and say that I think we'll have a lot in common in terms of being encouraged by the engage early, as you call it, engage often, looking at the region holistically, seeing the Iraq Study Group report as very much a kind of guiding document in terms of how you begin to look at the region holistically, and the prioritization of, despite the small numbers of people involved, but the almost iconoclastic importance of the Israel-Palestine issue, therefore meriting that priority. And as you said, this sense, and it's a very strong sense in the region, that the window on the possibility of a two-state solution is closing because of the realities on the ground, and also because of people's perceptions that you're not actually going to be able to change it if you continue to create those realities on the ground. So I think there's a significant amount of agreement in those areas. But I want to pick up on this issue of Palestinian unity, because that's probably where one's seen the least change in terms of the approach of the Obama administration. You mentioned your background in working in the West Bank for some years. My background, of course, is British accent and growing up in the UK notwithstanding. I moved out to Israel in 91 and spent 16 years there until I came on this sabbatical here, and worked in the Israeli government and in Israeli think tanks. And clearly one of the major issues that the people doing what I used to do and who are in Israeli government now have pointed to is, where's the Palestinian partner? There's two points I'd make. One is this question of where we haven't seen change. The Palestinians held elections. The Fatah party was defeated. There were many reasons for that election outcome, not least the way Fatah managed the Palestinian Authority for the better part of 12 years since its creation. Also, the way that they failed to deliver on essentially the promise of creating a Palestinian Authority. The idea wasn't to create a structure that would manage islands of Palestinian self-governance. The idea was that this was a precursor to establishing a Palestinian state and to ending the occupation. And Hamas could point to the fact that Israel left Gaza following an intifada, not following negotiations. Hamas wins that election in January of 06. Immediately conditions are placed on Hamas. If the West would interact in any way with that government, and if the West were going to provide financial assistance to that government. The Obama administration has maintained that same position. So you now interact with what is not a democratically elected Palestinian Authority government running the West Bank, and you have a situation in Gaza where Gaza is still, to all intents and purposes, there's some press reports today that some additional materials will be allowed into Gaza, but not seen that actually happen. And the fact in Gaza is that it's closed off, and you have Hamas rule there. We haven't seen a change in approach. There's still, ostensibly, at least what I'm seeing in practice, the idea that you can strengthen the moderates and we'll worry about Gaza later. I think that's a mistaken
approach.
I don't
disagree with you there. I actually don't, and I think in our report we note that. I think, you know, and I think you're talking about the jargon that's used is the quartet conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Senator Mitchell, the special envoy for President Obama on these issues, has staked out a slightly different position from the Bush administration when it comes to a unity government in tone.
I think that's right.
But in terms of the quartet conditions, they've not moved a single inch on this. And I think there's a reason for that. I mean, I think there are legitimate reasons why those conditions exist, first of all. And then second, if anyone wants to move beyond them, it's not just a matter of just saying polemically or making the moral case for it or even the intellectual case. It is actually doing politics on it here in Washington, around the world with all of the other members of the quartet. And then including in Israel too, which is I think the biggest challenge, because if those conditions, if the argument that one makes is that those conditions need to change to a certain extent, then that's going to, just starting here in this town,
will you come
require
up,
a lot
you,
of legwork on Washington, you know, on Capitol Hill here in Washington.
Will you come up with something that I'll echo something that appears in your report. I think it's underemphasized in your report, if anything. And it's an idea that I've been talking about and would very much promote. And you address how one could get around that problem in Washington to explain how could you appropriate money through Congress to a government that includes Hamas. And I would argue don't. I would argue
Right. Let
the Palestinians form it. And you say it in your papers. Again, I would say place more of an emphasis on that. You let the Palestinians, and I'm not saying they'd be able to negotiate a unity agreement, but at least remove the American pressure not to do so. Let the Palestinians negotiate their own government. If that government doesn't meet American standards, then don't fund it. But don't prevent others from funding it. I think what happened...
Yeah. No, and I think it's, you know, it's an important point that I don't disagree with, and it's amplifying one of the main points of the paper, in that there is a very serious crisis of legitimacy that's emerging for Palestinian leaders across the board, whether it's Fatah, whether it's the Prime Minister Fayyad, or even Hamas. I see this, and again, I worked in the Gaza Strip and Ramallah about 10, 12 years ago. In some ways, I feel like we've rewound the situation back to even pre-Oslo period, where we were back in 1991, where people are asking, who are the legitimate Palestinian representatives? Israelis are asking that, but guess what? Palestinians are asking that question. And that's why we stressed in the first part of the report, though some of these initiatives on economic development and security force development might be part of the formula, you can't avoid talking about these tough political issues of political legitimacy among Palestinian leaders. And I see that as part of the thing that is not part of the debate here in Washington as much as it should be. It's going to require people thinking differently. It's going to require asking the tough question of, do you really want to roll the dice on another round of Palestinian elections? We come down in our paper of, well, if President Abbas wants to, as he indicated he would like to shortly, if Prime Minister Fayyad wants to, who are we as outsiders to say you can't have these elections?
Well, except of course, President Abbas's term of office expired in January constitutionally, and Salam Fayyad, much as I like both of the individuals as individuals, Salam Fayyad's premiership has no constitutional validity whatsoever.
Right, exactly.
So to use that, I mean, carry on, Brian.
Yeah, this makes the argument all the more stronger for thinking through. I mean, this is the irony in all of this, is that a lot of the intra-Palestinian political fights and the questions of legitimacy are things that I don't think Americans or any outsiders have as much control over. They can shape and influence those things. But ultimately, if Hamas is not going to allow Fatah members to go to the party conference in Bethlehem next week, if they're going to hold those members hostage to some sort of deal to try to get prisoner releases, which I think President Abbas actually announced, but as far as I understand, have not been fully implemented.
No, not implemented.
Which is interesting to me, but it's a difficult point that yes, the U.S. needs to focus on the issue of political legitimacy among Palestinians. It goes back to the question that many Israelis raised during our visit of who is our partner. And sometimes that's a question that I think is raised as an excuse. But I think when you look at the sharp divisions among Palestinians, it's a very legitimate question. And I don't think simply doing robust economic development in the West Bank or building national security forces is simply the answer. It requires some discussion of what will the next elections look like, how do you share power. Palestinians will have to decide these sorts of things, but ultimately we, the Americans or others on the outside, can't be seen to be doing things as impeding that process from moving forward.
Except, and your report at least says, you know, this is part of what's needed, the economic development,
right.
The infrastructure of a Palestinian authority. And I would say no. I would say we actually have to start saying boo to what is a bogeyman. And what I'm talking about there is the following. The Palestine Liberation Organization made a commitment in 1988 to accept the UN resolutions, to thereby accept a two-state solution. On the back of that, the then Reagan administration here began a dialogue with the PLO. That was before Israel began a dialogue with the PLO. 5 years later, Israel and the PLO formally exchanged letters of mutual recognition. A national liberation movement, problematic as it was, the PLO, a national liberation movement basically morphed in the Oslo process into a body that would begin to manage self-governance in an area that it was assumed would become a Palestinian state, and there was a timetable. The idea was the PLO couldn't live in this twilight zone indefinitely. The twilight zone being, on the one hand, you maintain the PLO as a liberation movement, on the other hand, you create a Palestinian authority as a self-governing body that is significantly short of being sovereign or a state. That's 15 years ago now. So I think the entire idea of a Palestinian authority has passed its sell-by date. And I think what you actually have now is a structure that in many ways conveniently manages the occupation for Israel, is a convenient recipient of international donor assistance. I think it's a waste of American taxpayer money, of European taxpayer money, of Arab assistance to the extent to which there is Arab assistance. And you have this Palestinian authority sitting there, being something that the Palestinians fight over, being something that actually has very little ability to do anything. I cruelly, perhaps, have sometimes suggested that a kid with a train set in their bedroom has more relevance in terms of defining things to do with transportation than a Palestinian Authority transportation minister, with 600-plus obstacles to Palestinian freedom of movement in the West Bank. Why do you have a Palestinian Authority transport minister? They have virtually no role. So you have this Palestinian Authority sitting there, and I think one actually has to acknowledge that you have to define the political issues. And trying to build the Palestinian Authority under these conditions is a recipe for constantly delegitimizing Palestinian leaders' ability to look credible in the eyes of their own people. I don't think there should be more elections under these circumstances.
I see your argument. I don't completely agree with it because I think, to a certain extent, you present a false choice. And this is why I think I have a little bit more. I support a little bit more the economic development initiatives, especially those that are being operated through the private sector.
I mean, I don't disagree with that, but don't have a Palestinian authority.
I hear your point on the Palestinian Authority, and in fact, some senior officials in the Palestinian Authority made your same point on several visits, not even this last visit, but last year too. They made this point of the crisis of just relevance in their own society, their ability to do certain things, to get things done. Because of the constraints that are placed upon them. I still think that you can work for progress on the political front while continuing to try to develop the different ministries, including things like the health ministry, the work that I think they're trying to do in USAID and a number of others, working through to develop the hospitals and the hospital systems. I think there's a way to use these institutional development programs to build the trappings of an eventual Palestinian state. But it's got to go hand in hand with high level diplomacy, with a real strong commitment, not just rhetorical commitment to a two-state solution, but some real action on that front. And it needs to be comprehensive. I don't think we should simply say, let's, and I don't think this is what you're saying, cut off funding for the Palestinian Authority and let it die and wither until all the political issues are resolved. I do think that it's important for outside actors not to use the instruments of economic development or security force assistance as a means to stoke fights between different Palestinian factions, which is separate from building state institutions or potentially, you know, institutions that would serve as a Palestinian state. Go ahead, Daniel. Sorry.
No, I mean, I'll tell you where I think it actually perhaps does net damage. First of all, this isn't really, and we misrepresent it, I think, when we call this assistance to the Palestinians, and budgets are passed through the US Congress, and there was a commitment in a video conference between Secretary Clinton and Prime Minister Fayyad of the West Bank PA just last week for $200 million in immediate budgetary assistance. I think we should understand this isn't really assistance to the Palestinians. This, if we're being honest, is part of the aid budget to Israel. As an occupying power, Israel actually has the responsibility for education and health, etc., etc. And Israel undertook that responsibility. It did it well, it did it not so well, until 1994. In fact, this removes a burden that an occupying power under international law should carry out. The more problematic part of this, I would argue, is that, And you've said this, but I think one has to be very clear. It begins to set hurdles and preconditions for actually ending the occupation and creating statehood. Now, don't get me wrong. I think it's absolutely legitimate, and if I were ever in an official role in Israel again, would very much stand for the idea that there cannot be a vacuum of security or governance in the areas from which Israel withdraws, in the areas that would be designated for Palestinian statehood. Israel has a right to know that its security interests and its interest in not having governance chaos on the other side of that border would be addressed. But I think we also have to acknowledge that in a significant way, perhaps, part of addressing that is going to have, in the first phases, to come not just from the Palestinians, but from the international community, because there's only so far you can go in building up Palestinian governance infrastructure and in building up Palestinian security infrastructure while the Israeli presence is still there. You look at some interesting points in your report, and I was going to ask you to comment on that, which is the
right.
Security
forces. Actually, I can say I'm in violent agreement with you there, because on some of the health sector officials that we met with, you know, the head of a hospital, a very important hospital, he made your point. He said essentially, in the absence of a state, in the absence of any constitution or legal framework, we don't have a regulatory framework that actually helps us regulate our industry. And that being the hospitals and medicine, that we don't have control over our own affairs. That's one of the conundrums and the difficulties of actually trying to help build institutions in a quasi-state environment. And that's why I think President Obama and maybe Bibi Netanyahu, they're all in full agreement, at least rhetorically, of a two-state solution. Without perfect clarity in terms of who controls this, without having that legal framework and regulatory framework, you won't be able to have the sort of full development programs that one might have in the West Bank. And, you know, and going back to the first point, while the Palestinians are still very sharply divided over political issues and over power sharing, I think it's very difficult to see how you can come to some sort of arrangement without settling some of these questions, whether it's in an election or through the negotiations in Cairo, of how you're going to reestablish a true Palestinian authority, not one that's just sitting in Ramallah. One point, and you were going to go to some of the points in the paper, I want to stress, and I was struck by a couple of points that we heard during our trip on the General Keith Dayton's mission, because it's gotten a lot of good press, I think, in the New York Times and NPR and other things. And I was struck by how there are actually more shades of gray and a lot more nuance and even questions being asked by some of the people who are even implementing or involved in implementing these efforts, that if you duck beneath the surface in the veneer of, well, we're just helping build security forces that are enforcing the rule of law and enhancing the security situation, I think you actually touch upon, we heard this in several of our interviews, some very complicated questions that reminded me of when I was back there in the 1990s, where there were several initiatives that were well-funded to build Palestinian security forces that were never connected to the overarching political architecture or the sorts of institutions, the civil institutions that would oversee these functions. And I think there's people should ask more questions about all of these efforts to develop the Palestinian security forces. What are they actually intended to do? What is the training that's happening in Jordan at JIPTIC right now? It's worth asking, because I think there's some genuinely good things being attempted here. But it doesn't fit with a broader program of trying to advance rule of law and governance and truly building the foundations of a Palestinian state, or is it something different if people are getting trained in rules of engagement, military style type of combat? And I think that's another issue where I think Congress and others should look at the mission and see if the pieces all add up.
Well, I mean, what concerns me, and it follows on from that, is that, of course, if you build security forces, but their job is limited to basic policing duties on the street, which is important, but also to protecting Israel from the Palestinians, but they are not perceived by their own people as having a protecting role for them, whether it be vis-a-vis the IDF or the settlers, then you lose credibility, obviously. Your own people begin to look at you as a subcontractor. And I know that General Dayton is keenly aware of that concern. What worries me is we've been through this story already, where you do work in building up Palestinian security forces. As you say, Brian, you don't address the bigger political picture. You don't actually create the state and the occupation. And so when, inevitably, when there is a clash, because the Palestinian political aspiration for basic freedom is not acknowledged, the Israeli presence is maintained. Israel, in maintaining its presence, has to carry out certain security missions. You have this clash. Then those security forces end up turning their guns on Israel. And I think if this goes on, this process goes on, you will see those forces delegitimized in their own public's eyes and probably going down that route again. I also think it's naive, if I can use that word, to think that what will unlock a two-state solution for the Israeli side is saying, now we have Palestinians who are very good at doing security, now we can hand over to them. I think there's a certain bar that this reaches where the Israeli side says, okay, you can have X number of security people with X amount of training, with X amount of arming, a limited amount, but no more, because we don't really actually want them to pose a threat to us, understandably. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a rather doomed mission. My own view, which addresses both this and what you said before about, well, what do you do if there's no Palestinian unity, is I use the phrase build it and they will come. I think the only way forward now on the two-state solution is actually to create the Palestinian state with an international role on security, with an international role on governance, and then hand that over to a Palestinian polity that will agree on its own rules of the game. But I don't want to get too bogged down in that. I thought we'd maybe, if it's all right with you, switch to something else that you mentioned in the report that has become something of a bon ton here in the US, in Washington.
Right.
You talk about the need for a strategic communication effort by the Obama administration to the people in the Middle East, and notably to Israel. And an Israeli journalist had a piece in the New York Times just very recently, saying, come and talk to Israel, and you hear this everywhere. Obama has to speak to the Israelis. I wonder if that's part of your recommendations. I wonder if you could unpack that for us.
Well, essentially, I mean, we heard many comments from a range of Israelis, including those on the left, who were saying this whole bit about a settlement freeze, we don't get it. It has not animated a debate, a very strong debate within our own country here. We see how it's aimed at boosting America's credibility among the Palestinians and more broadly in the Arab world. And unfortunately, President Obama, the Obama administration, doesn't seem to have gotten much of a commitment from the broader Arab world, from Saudi Arabia and others. And this is these are Israelis talking. But we don't understand, you know, the sharp focus on the settlement freeze at a time, and it's raising some concerns with the Israeli public. And you see this in some of the polls about whether the United States' commitment to Israel will remain strong. And, you know, in my view, and this is the one of the recommendations we have in there, is that not only have President Obama speak directly to the Israeli public to emphasize that, I think, as you've said in your writings, Daniel, that we can play the role of an honest broker while maintaining a special relationship with Israel. We can do both at the same time. But to be able to do that effectively, you need to actually have more robust strategic communications effort, not only the president going at some point to Israel and maybe delivering a speech, but having a more consistent effort day in, day out on the ground, where you have U.S. officials that are engaging in the cacophony of Israel's very lively debate over a range of issues, not only the Israeli-Palestinian front, but the questions of Iran and other things. And this is not to say that we don't have people who do that, and certainly these visits this week with a bevy of envoys going out there, from Mitchell to Dennis Ross and Jim Jones, and Secretary Gates was out there. This focuses, I think, the press's attention, but when these visits are done, to a certain extent, I think the voice of America in those, I think, very rich, complicated debates inside of Israel, inside the Palestinian Authority, and in the broader Arab world, is there's not, I think, as consistent of a voice explaining the U.S. position. And on the Israeli side, why I think this is necessary is that, look, Israel's got a very free and open press, as you know, and it's got a diversity of views. And that I think there's a pretty clear message, I think, that President Obama has in his support for a two-state solution, but doing it not at the expense of Israel's security, but in fact to benefit Israel's security. And having someone, having a team, and I think, you know, the Mitchell team is having a bit bigger of a presence on the ground, having someone engaging in that debate on a day-to-day basis, I think, is necessary to build the political capital, to build the confidence, to allay the concerns of not only the Israelis, but all of the parties around. I think communications is a big part of this effort.
No, I actually think that's a far more sophisticated articulation of the idea of communicating with the Israelis than what I'm hearing from most other people in this town. So I appreciate you giving that, and it ruins my chance to actually try and find something to really disagree with you on.
Because some people are using it as an excuse, I think, as often, and as you know, and Daniel, from your experience, often excuses are raised or hurdles are raised that are just, I think, aimed at stalling or impeding some sort of process here. And I actually think, you know, in my understanding of the U.S.-Israel relationship is that it's a strong strategic relationship. We've weathered a lot, and we will weather a lot, but it's going to require constant communication. People talk about, I think there's a lot of hyperventilating about, you know, Obama trying to damage the relationship and other things. And I don't see that. I actually think that the relationship between our people and the Israeli people is strong and will remain strong. Does that mean we'll always disagree on every single issue as the difficult process of trying to move forward on the two-state solution? It moves forward? No. And we're not going to agree all the time. But that's okay. We can disagree on tactical issues. We may actually have slight differences on strategic questions. But having that communication ongoing, I think, is essential to boost the confidence of the Israeli public. And on many of the key issues, and you know this, two-state solution, you've got at least two-thirds support among Israelis for a two-state solution. On settlements, it's a bit more divided. But the fact that it's divided, to me, makes it seem like this is a winnable argument if one believes that settlement expansion needs to stop. To be able to make that happen, though, in a society like Israel, which has, as I said, a free and open press and it's this constant media environment, we need to engage. We need to actually have a consistent, constant voice that's out there, and not just showing up every couple of weeks or so on key missions.
Now, I obviously have nothing at all against Obama and the administration being out there explaining their positions to the Israelis. Obama is, of course, elected to be president of the United States, not of Israel. But I think it's important to have the public on board. I like what you're suggesting in terms of the kind of ongoing strategy and the not Obama-centric strategy. I think one of the things that has been impressive in the way that President Obama has addressed this issue is that he's constantly talked about what he's trying to do in terms of the US interest, of course, but also in terms of the Israeli interest. And I think that's very important. What has struck me is the bordering on silliness, let alone forgetfulness, of some of the I think in the New Republic, for instance, which is perhaps par for the course, that we've seen in saying, oh my God, you must talk to the Israelis, the relationship is in a terrible place. I don't think it is at all. I think you saw in the Pew survey, by the way, yes, the numbers in Israel went down, but they're still way higher than virtually anywhere else in the world. People forget.
No, absolutely. And I don't think we're in free fall. I think there's a lot of chicken littleism. I think we're still above 70% as a country.
Yeah, so it's about, exactly, it's above 70%.
And people, Israelis, which push us up there. And I think, again...
Let me just finish the... Sorry.
No,
and people forget, only in year 7 of his presidency did President Bush visit Israel. He didn't visit Israel until year 7 of his presidency. Now, I also want to push back against, and it's not your saying this, you were suggesting that this is a view held by some in Israel, and I think that's true, and it's certainly a view held by some here. I've been debating David Frum, who's sometimes a sparring partner here on Blogging Heads TV, just debated him in The Economist about whether Obama's an honest broker, and he suggested this idea that what Obama is trying to achieve with this settlement freeze initiative, is to appease the Arabs, is to look good. And I really think it's important to put that in a context. If President Obama really wanted to try and change the way the US is perceived vis-a-vis its favoritism towards Israel in terms of being blamed for the occupation, etc., does anyone really think that having an open disagreement with the Israeli government over a settlement freeze, in which America doesn't impose a settlement freeze, because what we're moving towards is a partial moratorium with exemptions and with some get-out clauses in Jerusalem, which is way short of a settlement freeze. Is that really going to impress anyone? The kind of measures America would need to take, if that's really the goal, if the goal is, hey, we don't think we can make peace, but let's stick it to the Israelis a bit to look good in the Arab world. I think people have very little idea, conception, of how this is perceived. What you'd have to do as America, and I'd be against doing this, in order to achieve that, use of American weapons by Israel in the occupied territories, the fact that the products from settlements can enter America under the free trade agreement, etc., etc. I think people are being silly. Is the only word to describe it, by suggesting that's what Obama is trying to achieve. I am in favor of him explaining the policies to the Israeli public, but here's something that worries me, and I want to point that out when we're discussing this point. Settlements are an important wedge issue because it's difficult to support settlements in America, and Israelis don't support settlements. At the moment, the message from the Obama administration comes across to Israelis as a little bit out of context. He seems to be talking about a settlement freeze for its own sake or in order to get some minor goodies from the Arabs. I think once the Israelis hear that the way to resolve this issue is by defining a border, by getting a two-state solution, then you begin to get a very different debate in Israel. If the debate is all about a settlement freeze, and I'm in favor of a settlement freeze, but I'm saying if it's all about a settlement freeze, I think the public says, well, you know, what? Why? They don't really get it. If the Americans pivot and say, wait a minute, take for example, Ma'ale Adumim. It's a settlement close to Jerusalem, a very large settlement. Building in the area around Ma'ale Adumim would be devastating for a two-state solution. Okay, Ma'ale Adumim. I think if the American position were to be, we have a principle. It's a principle set out in the roadmap. It's a principle agreed to in the past. Anything over the green line, there has to be no expansion. no change in the status quo until there's a final status agreement. If you want to talk about Me'alei Adumim, we can't talk to you about it in the context of where you're allowed to build settlements now. That goes against the principle we just discussed. Mm-hmm. However, if you want to talk about Me'alei Adumim in the context of a border, of a two-state agreement, come to the negotiating table. We will be understanding, for instance, on Me'alei Adumim perhaps. That could be part of the land swaps, but that's the place to talk about it, not exemptions to a settlement freeze. And I think once you put it in that context, you would have a very different type of receptivity and understanding in terms of that vigorous internal Israeli debate that you were talking about.
Right, yeah. And you've heard they've trial ballooned at least the talks, beginning some talks on permanent borders, which I think would be a favorable step in the right direction. It all begs the question of then, you know, how do you move forward in that process given the crisis of legitimacy among some Palestinian leaders? And how do you define, you know, and how do you actually sell a deal? You might be able to move forward in those regards, but it's still, you know, that's the thorn the big thorn where we started out inside of this whole process the Palestinian disunity. But I fundamentally agree. I mean, I went to Me'alei Adumim, saw the E1 area. All of this is east of Jerusalem. People can look at AmericanProgress.org. I did a photo essay of these areas with maps. And I've been back several times to that part of the world since I lived there in the 1990s. But the landscape has fundamentally changed, which is why, you know, we highlighted what I see as a closing window of opportunity. I agree with you, Daniel. If the construction and the building continues in those areas, if the northern West Bank is cut off from the southern West Bank, we already have the division between the West Bank and Gaza. I think you're going to have, if there's a Palestinian state created in that sort of context, it's not going to look like any other state in the world, and it may make it virtually impossible. Why I think this is the next 12 to 18 months is crucial on this front. And I'm glad that the Obama administration is putting such an emphasis on this, and I think they're doing a good job. What I was saying in the beginning is that they're doing this in the context of trying to do many other things more broadly in the region, and including trying to address Iran, which I don't know if we want to close out on the broader question of Iran.
We should probably be closing, but go on.
What's that?
We should probably be closing, but go on.
Yeah, but so we can close out on this question, because I think it's a very relevant issue. Obviously, I think it was the focus of the talks between Secretary Gates and Israeli leaders this week, and it was raised by Israelis too while I was there as a serious concern, and I think points to the fact that at least those in the region, Israelis, when I was in the Gulf, Arab Gulf earlier this year, they see this as a looming challenge, and as you know, the Obama team tries to move forward on the two-state solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they've got to multitask. They've got to figure out what to do with Iran. We don't address it in our paper, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on the next steps, because in some of your previous articles before the Obama administration came into office, I'd love to hear what you're thinking in terms of what's next on Iran, given what happened in the elections last month and as the dust settles from all of that.
I think, first of all, I think you're right. One needs to connect the dots, and the Israel-Palestine unresolved issue is a gift that keeps giving for the Iranians, because the Iranian current regime, because it can use this issue to certainly speak above the heads of leaders in the Arab and Muslim world and use it to rally people around. Likewise, if there were movement with Iran, it would make things easier on the Israeli-Palestinian and Israeli-Arab front, because we've occasionally used this phrase comprehensive effort, and I would very much advocate trying to move the Syrian talks. That frees up the ability to move the Lebanon talks. That allows you to bring in the other Arab states, work with the Arab Peace Initiative, get normalization with Israel in the context of a comprehensive deal. My own sense at the moment on Iran is the dust is still settling. The criticism of Ahmadinejad is coming not just from the reformist Mousavi protest movement opposition camp. Also now there's some discomfort in the conservative camp. I think there's a I think there's a period of patience required. Now, that's difficult in the context of people's concerns as to how fast an enrichment program may be progressing. I listened very closely to the reports on the comments of the head of the Israeli Mossad recently, who talked about nuclear weaponization not before 2014. So while I don't think we should be wasting time, I also don't think we need to have a stopwatch in our hand right now. So I think there's a moment of patience here as that dust continues to settle. I think there are new opportunities that have emerged because of what's happened recently in Iran. I think this makes engagement more difficult on balance, unless something else changes. But I think it makes the effort to show that one is willing in a serious way to engage and to allow Iran to have its rights under the NPT, as long as what's gone on in the past is addressed, chapter and verse, and as long as additional safeguards are added in the future. So that's where I think we are on Iran. And that obviously impacts what I think is an additional reason for urgency on the Israeli-Palestinian front, on the comprehensive Arab-Israeli front. I wouldn't want it to be hostage to that Palestinian division. I do just want to go back and make this one point.
Right.
First of all, as we've both said, the Palestinians should be actively encouraged to get their act together politically. If that can't be done, I still don't think it's a reason to expand settlements or maintain the occupation. I think it's a reason to think differently about how you legitimize the borders of a Palestinian state. And I think there you'll need a stronger Arab role than an exclusively Palestinian role in terms of who your negotiating interlocutor is. And it means you have to think different about how will Palestine be governed in the early years of its independence. And here you might need more of an international role. It happened in East Timor. It happened in Bosnia with a higher representative. It might have to happen in Palestine. I don't think it's a reason or an excuse for not actually moving forward, getting the two-state solution. So I would suggest that as a way around this difficulty.
Well, good. And if I could just say in conclusion before we wrap up, I mean, I think here we are in the summer of 2009, and during my last trip to Israel, I was really comparing it to three summers ago in 2006, mm-hmm. when Israel was fighting a war on the northern border, was facing threats from Gaza in the south, and you had King Abdullah of Jordan warning of the potential for three civil wars in the region, Iraq, Lebanon, and on the Palestinian side. You had Iran moving forward with its nuclear program as it continues in increasing in its regional influence. And I think we have a quite different, to a certain extent, neoconservatism and its policies actually brought the region to the brink. The ideological approach to foreign policy, the notion that freedom and democracy will defeat terror and extremism, really, I think, helped cause a lot of the problems and the lack of security in the region. And I think with President Obama, we have at least a pragmatic leader who understands that you've got to address all of these issues simultaneously, that it's not going to be easy by any means. We may disagree on tactics with some of our key allies, but moving forward on it is the only way to go. And I'm disconcerted by some of the conservative voices who just want to try to freeze things into place when I see actually there is a window to move forward, very narrow on the Israeli-Palestinian front, but on a range of these issues. And I'm glad at least, you know, we have this debate. We disagreed on some things, but I think this constructive debate of how the United States can use its power to advance the situation in the Middle East, which is really pulled back from the brink, is not perfect by any means. But I think is in a better situation than it was 3 years ago, certainly. And the only way forward, I think, is to continue to try to work these issues day in, day out. But thanks for the conversation.
No, I feel that obviously one did need to move on to a new page. My own personal perspective was that those were bad years for Israel, the years of a neocon-driven policy agenda. I think it's a more unstable region. It's a less secure reality for Israel, and that greatly concerns me. I think that in moving towards greater pragmatism, one of the things the Obama administration will have to do is to wean some of the Arab states that that kind of developed an interest in that neocon approach, and some in Israel who developed an interest in that approach, wean them to a more pragmatic set of policies. I think that can be done. And if Iran does not want to get on board with that, but you make progress on these other fronts, then I think Iran will become increasingly isolated. I think you'll remove some of its capacity to influence the region, and I think that will in the end affect Iran's calculations, just ending on that. And I agree, it's good to have these kind of conversations, and I've enjoyed having this chat with you, Brian.
Great, thanks Daniel.
Cheers, bye bye.